From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the life and work of Carl Jung, one of the most influential and controversial figures in the history of psychoanalysis. We'll talk with his biographer, Deirdre Baer, about his theories, his falling out with Freud, and the controversies that have surrounded him, including accusations that he was a Nazi sympathizer and that he stole his theory of the collective unconscious. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews some new reprints of long-lost detective and pulp fiction written by women. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The U.S. military says it killed 54 Iraqi fighters yesterday after the fighters tried to ambush U.S. convoys in the northern town of Samara. Residents of the town, which has been a center of resistance to the occupation, claim the U.S. troops killed and injured dozens of civilians in the fighting. NPR's Ivan Watson traveled to Samara earlier today.
For several chaotic hours yesterday afternoon, Samara became a battleground during the bloodiest shootout this country has seen in 7 months. Storefronts, vehicles, and even a holy Muslim shrine are now all riddled with bullet holes. The U.S. military says insurgents suffered huge casualties here after they tried to ambush an American convoy delivering money to a bank. But residents like this local doctor claimed there were no insurgents. He accused the U.S. troops of simply opening fire on civilians.
The soldiers start to shoot the civilian people in the markets haphazardly in all the directions. Most of the injured people was women and children.
Ivan Watson, NPR News, Baghdad.
The Homeland Security Department has stopped a controversial program that required tens of thousands of foreign men and boys to register while they were in the United States. The program affected visitors from 25 nations, mostly in the Middle East. Homeland Security Undersecretary Asa Hutchinson says the program wasn't effective.
This was really not a beneficial tool for us. It was a hardship on those that were coming to our country after they had been carefully inspected at our port of entry.
Critics of the program said it was intrusive and unfairly targeted people on the grounds of nationality. A jury has been seated in the manslaughter trial of South Dakota Congressman Bill Janklow. Kurt Nikich reports from South Dakota Public Radio.
9 women and 4 men are entrusted with the fate of the dominant Republican in South Dakota politics. Prosecuting and defense attorneys selected the 12 jurors and one alternate from a pool of 90 people. One woman excused from jury duty left in tears, saying she loves Bill and is a big supporter. Others were dismissed for dealings with the local prosecutor, who also practices law here in Flandreau, Congressman Janklow's hometown. The 64-year-old lawmaker is charged with second-degree manslaughter and 3 misdemeanors for his role in an August traffic death. If convicted, Janklow faces a sentence of up to 10 years in prison just on the manslaughter charge. For NPR News, I'm Kurt Nikish in Flandreau, South Dakota.
Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Industrials gained 116 points or 1.2% to close at 98.99. The NASDAQ was up 29 points or 1.5% to close at 1989. This is NPR News. 8 of 9 mid-size SUVs crash-tested by a vehicle safety group have posted top ratings. Jerome Vaughn has more from Detroit Public Radio.
The Insurance Institute for Highway Safety rated the sport utility vehicles on several factors, including structural integrity and simulated injuries to a test dummy in a 40-mile-per-hour frontal crash. The group says the Toyota 4Runner, Lexus RX 330, Infiniti FX, and Cadillac SRX received the top rating of good, along with the Nissan Murano, Chrysler Pacifica, Mitsubishi Endeavor, and Honda Pilot. The Kia Sorento received an acceptable rating, the second highest. Both the Honda and Nissan vehicles were retested after their airbags deployed late during their first tests. The Institute says the high score shows significant progress in vehicle safety design since the organization began testing midsize SUVs in 1996. For NPR News, I'm Jerome Vaughn in Detroit.
U.S. retailers posted generally strong sales over the Thanksgiving holiday weekend, but shoppers were clearly looking for bargains. Britt Beamer heads the retail consulting firm America's Research Group.
Electronics stores showed the single greatest increase from a year ago in the number of shoppers, and the discount stores had by far the most amount of shoppers.
Big sales on the Friday after Thanksgiving don't necessarily mean that the rest of the holiday season will be strong. Many retailers posted record sales on the same day last year, only to watch sales lag throughout the rest of the season. In stocks today, the S&P 500 gained 12 points, or 1.1%, to close at 1,070. The NASDAQ was up 29, 1.5%, to close at 1989. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
The NPR Shop features a variety of NPR clothing selected especially for public radio listeners of all ages and sizes at npr.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Deirdre Baer, has written a new biography of one of the most important and controversial figures in the history of psychoanalysis, Carl Jung. He gave us the concepts of the archetype, the unconscious, the collective unconscious, the extrovert and introvert. Her new biography examines how Jung developed his theories and investigates the truth behind the controversy surrounding his life and his research. She's the first Jung biographer to conduct interviews with his family. She also gained access to the diaries, documents, and letters of co-workers, patients, and his mistress. Baer received a National Book Award for her biography of Samuel Beckett. She's also written biographies of Anna Snin and Simone de Beauvoir. Welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Some of the concepts that Jung is best known for are archetypes, the collective unconscious, anima and animus. Would you choose a couple of those and talk about what they are?
Well, let's start with the collective unconscious, which I think is the cornerstone of his psychology. This is information or knowledge that is common to all people, no matter what your race, class, ethnic background, where you live in the world. There are certain myths, for example, that pertain to everyone. Everyone has a version of a myth of an evil spirit, a devil, a princess being rescued, that sort of thing. One in particular, probably the most important, was the myth of the solar phallus. Jung had a patient who believed that he could create the weather by looking at the sun and making little tails that emerged from the sun move. And this was a myth that is found in about 7 or 8 or 10 different cultures. Anima and animus. The anima is the female component that every male has within him, and the animus is the masculine component that every female has within her. And frequently you will hear, her animus is out of control, meaning she's a very, very aggressive female, or his anima is predominant, meaning that he's kind of a wimpy fellow and probably should do more to express his masculinity.
Jung also coined the expressions New Age and Age of Aquarius. How would you describe his place in quote, New Age thinking?
Well, he's terribly important. You can't pick up a New Age publication without finding the adjective Jungian either preceding the phrase or somewhere very prominent in the subtitle. His philosophy seems to resonate, particularly as we move into the 21st century. The New Age, I think, is a way of combining, this, of course, is my own capsule simplistic definition, a way of combining religion, philosophy, a way of being in the world. And Jung seemed to have a great many qualities and characteristics in his psychology that that really people who espouse New Age ways of thinking tend to believe in.
And how would you describe Jung's place now in mainstream psychology?
This is very curious. It depends really on what philosophy, what particular leader within the field of psychology one follows. The Freudians, for the most part, do indeed have the knives out for anything Jungian. The Jungians seem to be all-inclusive. They will take anything from group therapy to transpersonal analysis, and they will incorporate what's useful within their system. So it's a very troubled position that Jung holds. And the reason I say that is because when he broke with Freud in 1913, Freud defined the terms of their breakup, of their split. Jung never really said anything about it. He continued to speak respectfully of Freud for the rest of his life. And so, therefore, Jung was seen as the ingrate, the usurper, the power-hungry, power-mad, crazy person, isolated in neutral Switzerland, that sort of thing. So he got a very bad rap from the beginning, and it tends to have stuck to him.
Well, this is one of the very controversial parts of his life and career. What were the disagreements about between Freud and Jung? Freud had been Jung's mentor.
Freud had been Jung's mentor. Jung read The Interpretation of Dreams and discovered that there was very, very much in this book that he could relate to. And so he went to Vienna to see Freud, to sit at Freud's feet. And Freud immediately said, "Oh, you are my crown prince. You are my heir." And to his other followers in Vienna, Freud said, "We need Jung because he's Christian. And psychology, psychoanalysis, is in danger of becoming known as the Jewish science because we are all Jewish. So we need this Christian to be a part of our emerging discipline." Jung was very, very happy to be Freud's follower, Freud's colleague. But Jung was not happy to accept the sexual basis of all behavior as the only governing, dominating facet of psychology. So eventually it was over the question of the libido, the sexual drive, that Jung and Freud fell out.
Because Freud felt that so much of human behavior comes from the sexual drive or the thwarting of the sexual drive, and Jung disagreed about that.
Yes, Jung said that there were other things. Jung gave a nod toward Adler by saying, "Power is important. People have a power drive." And Jung said, "People are hungry. The need for food, the need for the basic aspects of life, food, shelter, water, those sorts of things, they matter too. Human relationships matter that are not sexual. These all influence a person's character and behavior." And Freud insisted that really that the sexual drive was the all-important drive and that Jung had to embrace this entirely. And of course, by 1912, when he published the book Symbols of Transformation, he was simply unable to follow Freud down that path.
Well, when Freud and Jung split in 1913, it was a pretty bitter split, and I believe they never spoke again afterwards. How much of the split and the bitterness behind it had to do with differences in their beliefs of the underlying psychological principles that motivate men and women? How much of it was personal?
I have this absolutely enormous chapter with several hundred footnotes taking it step by step along the way. So it's hard to say it's half personal, it's half professional, because the two were so intertwined and so mixed up. But there's no question that Freud engineered the split. And Freud just kept accusing Jung of treachery and wanting to abandon him and wanting to usurp Freud's position and so on and so forth. And so Jung was silent. Jung never talked about it. But Freud immediately rushed into print his version of the history of psychoanalysis, claiming everything for himself and denigrating and denouncing Jung. And by this time, World War I had broken out. Jung was isolated in Switzerland. And there you have it. The break became solidified in stone, if you will. And each of the two held fast to a position that each held for the rest of their lives.
Is there any, of all the information that you were able to get about the relationship between Freud and Jung, is there any other, you know, anecdote or detail that you think would be really useful for us in understanding what was really behind their split?
Well, I'll talk about that in terms of Dr. Kurt Eisler, the late Kurt Eisler, who was the dean and some would say the dragon who guarded Freud's gates. And in the last years of Dr. Eisler's life, I had the privilege of interviewing him here in New York. And I would talk to him, and actually I would argue with him, I would contradict him, I would present evidence to show that perhaps a view that he held about the Freud-Jung split really wasn't entirely accurate. And one day I was sitting at home and my telephone rang, and it was Dr. Eisler, and he said, "You know, I had an interview with Jung in 1953. And I put it into the Library of Congress, and I restricted it until the year 2005. But I think of all the people who have written about the Freud-Jung split, you're telling the most truthful version we have to date. So I've just told the librarian at the Library of Congress to send you that interview." And I was absolutely stunned by this generosity. I'd never hoped to see this interview.
What did he say in that interview?
Well, he talked about Freud from the beginning. He talked about how he first went to see him and how from the beginning he was aware that he was probably not going to be able to follow Freud, even though he wanted to, that he could not call the sex drive, the libido, the cornerstone of his own way of approaching psychoanalysis. He talked about conversations that he had with Freud over various other points at issue. He discussed Freud's personal habits, Freud's way of being in the world, of relating to people. So from that perspective, it just gave me such depth and dimension to put the relationship into a very human perspective.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Deirdre Baer, and she's the author of a new biography of Carl Jung. An earlier book from the 1990s about Jung claimed that Jung had stolen the concept of the collective unconscious, one of the cornerstones of his theory of psychology, that he'd stolen it from one of his medical students. What did you find about that?
Well, I found a great deal about that. Starting around 1901, when Jung went to work at the Bergholtzli, that he had identified this patient as someone whose delusions were worth recording, worth following, worth writing down. Every medical student in Switzerland cannot become a practicing doctor until he or she writes a dissertation. And Jung, as the second in command at this Bergholtzli, was in charge of assigning the various under doctors topics for them to write their dissertation on. So he selected Honegger, who was extremely bright, very charismatic man, and he asked Honegger to follow the patient Emil Schweitzer. Honegger was in the midst of a psychotic breakdown. Indeed, at the end of 1910, he killed himself. He committed suicide. So Honegger followed the patient for a very brief time. So the question then arises of who wrote the papers, who compiled them, who put them together, who first identified the concept, and so on and so forth. And I simply followed the evidence. I followed the Honegger papers and a lot of other related documents.
So what did you conclude?
Well, my conclusion was that Jung identified the myth of the collective unconscious. Jung identified the solar phallus theory, which became the cornerstone. In 1901, he had no time to do the work himself. There are allusions to it in his letters to Freud as early as 1903, 1904. He's chafing that he can't do this work. He needs to find somebody to do it for him. And then he found Honegger, and he thought that everything would go to a very smooth conclusion. But Honegger had his psychotic breakdown and killed himself. So really, there's no absolutely definite answer. But common sense really should make one conclude that this was Jung's theory from the very beginning.
My guest is Deirdre Baer. She's written a new biography of Carl Jung. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Deirdre Baer, and we're talking about her new biography of Carl Jung. One of the interesting things about Carl Jung's personal life is that although he was married and had several children, he had a mistress most of his life, and his wife knew about it. How did Jung justify that to himself and to his wife?
You know, it was a very troubled, very dramatic situation for all three who formed this curious triangle. Emma Rauschenbach, Jung, was the second richest woman in Switzerland. Her family had a great, great fortune.
This was his wife.
This was his wife. And indeed, much of the work that Jung was able to do really was because, in the beginning at any rate, Emma's great fortune gave him the freedom and the possibility to do the kind of work that he wanted to do. Toni Wolff, the mistress, came to him when she was a very young woman, 19 going on 20. She was brought to him by her mother. She was the eldest of three daughters, and she had been very close to her father, who had just died. And she was deeply troubled, deeply depressed. And Jung found that in the analytic sessions he had with her, the way to get a response, the way to get her to communicate, was to talk to her about mythology, to talk to her about comparative religion, all the things that he was interested in, it turned out, that she was interested in too. So her therapy progressed as an intellectual experience that they shared. Indeed, he took her to the Weimar Analytic Conference in 1913 as a very young protege. He and his wife were her chaperones. Toni's family was present at the incorporation of the Swiss democracy in the 12th century. They were among the highest, highest social class in Zurich. There was no way in the world that Jung could dishonor Toni by having her proclaimed as his mistress openly. And the two of them, they really fought the attraction for a number of years. Emma knew about it. She was deeply, deeply upset. Toni's mother colluded in the lifelong relationship that Jung had with Toni to the world at large and to most of Zurich, which is a very small and very gossipy town even today. People didn't know that Jung and Toni had a physical relationship. They all thought that she was just his colleague. And this was because Toni's mother recognized the need for this relationship in her daughter and provided a screen. Jung was invited as a family friend to family lunches and dinners and this sort of thing. It was extraordinarily painful for the three of them, and there were various times throughout the 40 or so years that they had this relationship that the three of them would be in a lot of trouble in how they related to each other. But ultimately, to sum it up, I think Jung was one of the very few men in the world who was able to take two women and treat them as two wives separately but equally.
I know that Jung's wife considered divorce several times. Did Jung ever consider divorcing his wife and marrying his mistress?
No, never. The only thing that Jung considered was suicide. He told a very, very trusted colleague of his that one day he was swimming in the lake. He lived on the lake shore in the little town of Küsnacht, just outside Zurich. And he was swimming, and he thought to himself, the best thing for me to do would be to let go and drown because I'm causing so much unhappiness to the two people I love, and I see no way out. But, of course, he didn't. He swam back to shore, and he was just persuaded to muddle through. He really was not, you know, a lot of people consider him such a bully and such a misogynist and so unfeeling and uncaring about his wife and his mistress's attitudes or positions in life. And I didn't find that. I found a man who knew that he was hurting these two women and who cared deeply for each of them, but just couldn't see his way clear to choose one or the other.
What about his thoughts about women in general? I should mention to our listeners that one of your books is a biography of the great feminist writer Simone de Beauvoir. So what did you think of what Jung had to say about women and the role of women in the psychology of women?
I came of age in the generation of the 70s with that generation of feminists, and most of us rejected Freud, or at least if we didn't reject him outright, we found fault with him because we felt that he ignored our half of the human race. And I think that many feminist women were initially more comfortable with Jung, at least I know that I was, because he did talk about women. He wrote about women. Again, the concepts of anima and animus, the idea of the shadow, which is the darker, unpleasant part of the self. Women were using those concepts when they thought about their own personal psychology. So I found myself, I should say, much more comfortable thinking and writing about Jung than about Freud. When I wrote about Simone de Beauvoir, and of course when I wrote about Aeneas Nin, it was the same sort of thing. She had been in psychology, in psychoanalysis for over 40 years, and in the end she gravitated to Jungian analysts who gave her the most comfort and the most satisfaction.
Deirdre Baer is the author of a new biography of Carl Jung. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Books, publishers of Joel Meyerowitz's new volume of photography, Tuscany, Inside the Light, with text by Maggie Barrett. Available at Barnes & Noble bookstores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of The Murder Stone, a novel of family obsession and wartime secrets by Charles Todd. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, was Carl Jung a Nazi sympathizer? We continue our conversation with Deirdre Baer about her new biography of Jung. And book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews some reprints of long-lost detective and pulp fiction written by women. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Deirdre Baer. She's written a new biography of Carl Jung. He and Sigmund Freud were the two most important figures in the development of psychoanalysis. Freud was Jung's mentor, but after a falling out in 1914, Jung developed his own system of analytical psychology. In the new biography, Baer examines Jung's theories and the controversies surrounding his life and work. Let me ask you about your investigation into another claim about Carl Jung, which is that he was a Nazi sympathizer. And this is based in part on the fact that he accepted the presidency of a professional society in Germany during the Nazi regime, and he didn't resign from that position until World War II was well underway. What did you find about the claim that he was a Nazi sympathizer?
Well, to cut to the chase, that was unfounded. It's not, I don't believe it's true. What is true is that he was incredibly naive. He made many silly, stupid decisions in connection with this international society. His bottom line was that he was helping to save his Jewish colleagues. Very early on, Hitler decreed that anything pertaining to the Jewish science had to be gleichschaltet, which is the word for conformed, which means that psychology had to be subverted into Nazi ideology. And the way they did this was they just totally tried to do away with Freud. They had to invent new words for Freudian concepts. And they disqualified Jews from being able to practice professionally in any of the clinical sciences in Germany. So Jung was the vice president of this organization in 1933. And the president, a man named Ernst Kretschmer, resigned because he couldn't. He was a German. Kretschmer was a German. And he decided that he couldn't go along with Nazi doctrine, Nazi ideology. So Jung, as the vice president, immediately became the president. Now, Jung could have resigned, and probably in retrospect, with perfect hindsight, he should have resigned. But he didn't. He stayed president of this organization. And incidentally, this is the longest chapter of my book. It's over 100 pages, and it has, I think, close to 200 footnotes. I got all of the original correspondence between Jung and the Nazis. I got all of the government documents in Berlin, in Bern, and all these other places. And I just went through them, you know, step by step, day by day, more or less. And the conclusion is that Jung did a great deal to help individual Jews. He made it possible for them to become members of foreign chapters of this international society so that, in effect, they had a lifeline to their profession. When some of them found their way into Switzerland, and this was very few because Switzerland closed the doors very early to refugees, but if any of them came to Switzerland, Jung signed what is known as an attest that he would be financially responsible for these people if they couldn't support themselves. He also gave every single one of them free analysis. He didn't charge them any money. So individually, he did a great deal.
Now
he didn't.
What do you mean?
Well, collectively, he went on German radio. He gave interviews to German publications that they were able to take snippets from these essays, these convoluted essays that he wrote, and make them say whatever they wanted. And he kept writing about the difference of the Jewish character. It is unfortunate that he chose the Jewish character and culture at such a troubled time in our history. He used the Jew as an example of one who is not rooted in the land or in the soil, and therefore the Jew in Germany could never become a true German, could never assimilate. And of course, he started saying this sort of thing in 1918 at the same time as he warned that the German collective unconscious was forging itself into a fearsome being that the rest of the world was going to have trouble with in very short time period in years to come. So the fact that he continued to make these remarks is very, very damaging. It's just really stupid. It's not silly. It's not naive. It's just stupid that he did it.
Now, you also found that during World War II, the United States intelligence enlisted Jung to work with it. What work did the OSS ask Carl Jung to do during World War II?
Well, Carl Jung was Agent 488, and Alan Dulles, who was the director of intelligence in Central Europe, used to send Agent 488's analyses and dispatches to David Bruce in London, his Alan Dulles' superior. Primarily what Jung did, they would ask Jung to pass on any information that he got from his German clients, patients, whatever one wants to call them. They asked Jung if Hitler gave a speech, for example, or Goebbels or any of the other prominent German officials. They would ask Jung to analyze it, to tell them what was going on. Jung had a patient who was in the Abwehr, the German intelligence, and he was actually a double agent working with Dulles. So Jung was the go-between there. And then I think the most important thing of all, in the last desperate months of the war, when Eisenhower wanted the civilian populations of German cities to surrender, he wanted to drop leaflets from airplanes, and he asked Jung to read what he wrote and to make sure that the propaganda, for that's what it was, would appeal to the German mentality, that they would understand what it was that the Allies were asking them to do. So Eisenhower wrote in several letters that he really, really valued Jung's contribution to getting the war to end.
Is there an example of something that Jung either signed off on or said, no, this isn't going to work, you have to change, I suggest this?
Yes, he did. That also, I have a couple of those in the book, where he said, you have to appeal to the goodness in the German character. There is a big hole in how they think and how they feel at this particular time, and you have to fill that hole with goodness. You have to appeal to what is best in the German civilian mentality at this time.
So how did that translate into the propaganda?
Well, it was just the sentences, you know, if you surrender, the following will happen, and this is what we will expect of you. We will enlist you, the German populace, to help us in all these ways to rebuild your very troubled and destroyed country.
My guest is Deirdre Baer. She's written a new biography of Carl Jung. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Deirdre Baer is my guest. She's the author of a new biography of Carl Jung. Her previous books are biographies of Samuel Beckett, Simone de Beauvoir, and Anas Nin. Did you find that Carl Jung lived by the principles he wrote about? Now, you've said that those principles were pretty contradictory, but when you look at his life, do you walk away thinking that he was a hypocrite or a man of principle?
Oh, he was absolutely a man of principle. I mean, starting with the Freud business, when the break with Freud, he was absolutely principled. He said, well, if I'm not going to follow Freud anymore, I can't practice his psychology. I have to find my own. I can't use his terms and his definitions. I have to come up with my own. I can't do analysis the way he does. I have to find my own way of relating to the individual patient. And so, you know, starting with that, all the way through the rest of his life, particularly the relationship with Toni Wolff, the mistress, and Emma Jung, his wife, I have to honor both these women. I have created this situation where I have two women in my life. I have to honor them, and I have to give them both the same privilege. And he did that. And when he was writing about the difference in the Jewish character and culture, he said, this is a cornerstone of my philosophy, my psychology. I could take just as easily the Chinese character and culture as I could the Jewish, but the Jewish is more immediate and germane to who I am and where I live. And just on and on, when he was writing his memoir, Memories, Dreams, Reflections, and people wanted him to sanitize it, to clean up what he said. He said, well, I'm earthy, I'm vulgar, I'm a man of the soil. This is how I think, and this is what I'm going to say. And he did.
Young's family, who controls the Young estate, is known for being very protective of his journals and letters. What kind of access did you get? What do you wish you had access to but did not?
Well, I had access to everything but the private correspondence between Carl and Emma Jung, and this is very interesting. The concept of privacy in Switzerland is so intense and so different, say, from an American who, you know, there's nothing private in the United States. Everything is grist for the gossip mill here. But everything is terribly, terribly private in Switzerland. The family gave me absolutely unprecedented cooperation, and I'm very grateful to them. They let me see every archive, every correspondence, anything I wanted to see, except the letters that Jung and Emma wrote to each other. And these were mostly letters when he was away. He traveled a great deal, and she stayed mostly at home. And I said to one of the grandsons, who's a man in his late 60s, early 70s now, well, if you're not going to let me read the letters, could you at least just go and check to make sure when I say that Jung was in a certain place on a certain date, he really was? And the man said, oh, I couldn't possibly do that. He said, we, of course, have saved the letters, but no one will ever read them. Why, we would blush with shame to think that we would be reading the private correspondence of our grandmother and grandfather. So that's the only thing I didn't see. And, of course, I really do think it would be wonderful to have seen it.
Are any of the children still alive?
There's one, the last daughter, Emma Helene, who was born in 1914. She's still alive. I talked to, let's see, there were four surviving children when I started the work. Marianne had died of cancer in the 1960s. So I interviewed Franz Jung, the only son, and Agatha, the eldest daughter, and Griet, a very famous astrologer daughter. And I talked to Helene through her son, who was my major contact, but I never spoke to Helene personally. So of the four surviving children, I interviewed three extensively.
Did you talk to any of the children about what their reaction was to their father's almost lifelong affair with his mistress?
At great, great length, and I've written about it extensively throughout the text as at the various ages of the children, when they were young, when they were older. They really despised her. They were trained to call her Tante Toni, Aunt Toni, by their parents. And when they became older, they used this as a derision. They didn't do it with respect. They played terrible tricks on her. Practical jokes. They insulted her. They were not nice to her as they grew up. They resented her. They hated the fact that she came to Sunday lunch, which was the sacrosanct family occasion. And after Sunday lunch, Tony Wolf and Carl Jung would go off somewhere privately and talk, that he wouldn't be with the family. So the children really did not like her at all.
How did he explain his relationship with Tony Wolf to the children?
Well, he never did. That's the thing about the Swiss people, is they don't talk about things. You're just expected to know about them. And, you know, they are, as we now say, the elephant in the room that no one talks about. And so that's really how the relationship evolved. It stayed constant until about the 1940s. When he decided that he wanted to pursue research in alchemy, and she said, I'm not going to follow you there. If you go into alchemical reading and writing, people are going to say, aha, here's proof that he was the charlatan we always thought he was. And so she said, you can't do this. You know, you come from a Christian tradition. She had no understanding of what he wanted to do with alchemy. And she had no desire to follow him. And so that's really what caused the break between them. After about 1944, he was terribly cordial, civil, polite to her. But the personal relationship and the professional relationship both were finished.
Did writing this biography of Jung change your opinion of him in any fundamental way?
it answered a lot of questions for me. As I said, I had always been more sympathetic to Jungian psychology than I was to Freudian psychology. And again, that's because I was a feminist of the generation of the 1970s. But I started this book with one question in mind. There had been about four or five biographies before mine, and every one of them was so negative. None of these writers went to Zurich to do the research. Only one of them, Richard Knoll, knew the German language, could read German. They hadn't interviewed the family. They hadn't looked at any of the archives. It was sort of as if they sent a researcher into the library, and all the gossip and the innuendo, they put it together in a hit-and-run, cut-and-paste kind of book. And I thought to myself, this must be a man of some sort of extraordinary charisma or power, if so many people have such strong opinions about him. I'd better try to find out what's right, what's true. And so that was my purpose in writing this book. I wanted to find out the real reality, if you will. And I think I came pretty close. There was a lot about Jung that was not pleasant, unsavory. He was in many ways a bully. His nickname was the Barrel. He would bulldoze, steamroll anybody who was in his way. But on the other hand, he was a man of such personal integrity. He did what he thought he was right, no matter how it put him at odds with the rest of the world. So I ended up having a great deal of respect for him.
How much did you care about Jung before starting this book?
He was sort of on the periphery of my consciousness. Beckett had been taken by his analyst to go to hear Jung deliver the Tavistock lectures in 1935. And I really wish I had made more of that in the biography of Samuel Beckett, because it was very clear that the Jungian idea of the complex, the question of, you know, we have many little different selves within ourselves, this became so major in Beckett's writing. I wish I'd known more about it at the time. And even when I wrote about Simone de Beauvoir, when she was rejecting Freud, she was rejecting psychoanalysis because she couldn't accept Freudian doctrines and dictates. What she was really saying to me was, if I had to accept psychoanalysis, it probably would be from a Jungian perspective. So, and again, writing about Aeneas Nin, 40 years in analysis, Jung was always there in the background. And I think that Jung talked about synchronicity, when things happen and there's no clear connecting cause to make these things happen, but eventually they all add up into a single thing. He called that synchronicity. And I think perhaps I can use that word, synchronicity, to say that's how I came to write this book.
This final question is more personal, so feel free to not answer it if it's too personal. Have you ever been in psychoanalysis yourself? And has, you know, this Jungian research affected your thoughts about any analysis you'd been in or any interest you might have in doing that in the future?
Well, I never had a full formal analysis, but I talked to two different Jungian analysts. The first came when I was having a lot of trouble finishing the Beckett book. And this was at a time when all the goals and the roles for women were in question. And I was married and I had children, and all of my friends around me were taking off to find themselves and so on and so forth. And one of my neighbors said, "Well, why don't you come with me? I go to this analyst down in Westport." I was living in Connecticut then. And I said, "Yeah, that sounds like a good idea." And my friend said, "Oh, but I have to warn you, she's a Jungian." And I said, "Well, why do you say it that way?" And she said, "Well, you know, a lot of people don't really like him." So anyway, I went to this wonderful woman for 2 or 3 months, and in the process of going to her, I was able to conclude the Beckett book and get it ready for publication. I stayed married and dealt with my teenage kids and so on and so forth. And so I said to her, "Wow, this was fantastic. Why don't I go into a full-blown, full-scale analysis with you?" And she said, "Honey, I'm getting tired of the rich women of Fairfield County. I'm on my way to North Carolina, where I can work with the mountain people and collect some myths." So, no, I never had an analysis. That's as close as I came.
Well, Deirdre Baer, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Deirdre Baer is the author of a new biography of Carl Jung. Coming up, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews new reprints of long-lost detective and pulp fiction written by women. This is Fresh Air. Women's stories is a term that brings to mind the melodramatic weepies of the 1930s and even earlier the sentimental domestic novels of the 19th century that centered on home and hearth. But a collection of novels that have just been reprinted by two academic presses brings to light other kinds of hugely popular women's stories that seethe with intrigue, forbidden erotic desires, and murderous passions. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
In the 1970s, the first generation of feminist literary scholars exhumed the work of women writers and thus liberated the boys' club that was then the Western canon. Those heady days of discovery are now pretty much, but not completely, past. Two academic presses have recently republished some long-lost popular fiction by women, some of it startling, that gives readers that old feminist thrill of uncovering literary curios and even a genuine treasure or two. Edgar Allan Poe passes the magnifying glass to Dashiell Hammett, who then lobs it at Raymond Chandler. That's how the evolution of the American detective tale is commonly understood. And it's a crime, because two best-selling American women of mystery, Anna Katharine Green and Meta Fuller Victor, are missing from that lineup. To rectify the offense, Duke University Press has just brought out two thick paperbacks, each containing novels by each of these women, as well as smart introductory essays about their work. The name Anna Katharine Green is hardly unknown to detective fiction aficionados. Her best-selling 1878 locked room mystery, The Leavenworth Case, has been kept in print erratically. But the two novels Duke has reprinted, That Affair Next Door and Lost Man's Lane, are real eye-openers because of the radically new type of detective they introduce. In That Affair Next Door, which Green wrote in 1897, the character of the old maid Snoop was born in the shape of New York City spinster Amelia Butterworth. More egotistical than her famous successor, Agatha Christie's Miss Marple, Butterworth is always congratulating herself on her nerves of iron and on noticing clues that only a lady of quality would catch, like the department store origins of a dress on a corpse. Butterworth is meant to be funny, and she is, but in a Falstaffian kind of way. So to my taste, the greater find here is Meta Victor Fuller, and particularly her first novel, The Dead Letter. The Dead Letter was published in 1868, and the introduction claims it's the first American detective novel. Not the first written by a woman, just the. Remember, Poe, the father of the form, wrote only detective fiction short stories. The Dead Letter is soaked in Gothic atmosphere. It opens on a dark and stormy night in a house in the farmlands outside New York City where a young woman waits for her fiancé who never arrives, alive. Post-Civil War politics come into play in references to the recent annexation of California and the possibility of annexing Cuba. But domestic geography is what really distinguishes The Dead Letter, particularly the hemmed-in rooms and the constrained possibilities that mark the female characters' lives. Now on to some real genre slumming. The Feminist Press has just inaugurated a new reprint series called Femme Fatales, Women Write Pulp. The first three novels to appear give readers a good, rancid taste of pulp categories. In a Lonely Place was the 1947 noir novel by Dorothy B. Hughes that inspired the classic film noir of the same name, starring Humphrey Bogart. But Bogart's Dick Steele is a far more redeemable creature than Hughes's monster. In Faith Baldwin's 1930s romance, Skyscraper, a young woman exults in the autonomy that her job as a clerk in Manhattan grants her, but she also itches for the safety of marriage. Charting its heroine's adventures as what was then called a bachelor maid, Skyscraper also takes a gritty look at low-wage jobs during the Depression. And Valerie Taylor's 1950s Potboiler, The Girls in 3B, which went on to have a second life as a cleaned-up comic strip, tells the tale of three country gals who each make their way to Chicago. Two settle into marriages after brushes with lecherous bosses and beastly beatniks, but the third finds fulfillment in a lesbian relationship. Taylor's is one of the few pre-Stonewall novels, pulp or otherwise, where the sapphist heroines don't kill themselves or grimly resolve to go straight. I can't make claims of great literary value for any of these pulps, but they're certainly a lot of fun to read, as well as illuminating sociologically. The thoughtful afterwards to all these novels will supply readers with excellent defenses against those critics who dismiss pulps as pure trash. Nothing's pure. That's what these fascinating pulp and detective fiction reprints show us. Literary history is speckled with shadowy outsiders, and even some of the greatest books have their origins in the foul rag and bone shop of popular art.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. A complete list of the books she just reviewed can be found at our website, freshair.com. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today is Roberta Shurrock. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Starbucks, offering access to NPR holiday programming through the T-Mobile hotspot service, available at neighborhood Starbucks during this holiday season. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the rising costs of health care and health insurance. We talk with Chris Butler of Independence Blue Cross, Art Kaplan, chair of the Medical Ethics Department at the University of Pennsylvania, and Sherry Gleed, chair of the Department of Health Policy and Management at Columbia University. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.